Out in western Kansas, there's a brand new restaurant. There are chandeliers made from old windmills and bar stools repurposed from tractor seats. It's kind of like a homemade, homegrown Applebee's. Just outside, the streets are newly paved, flower boxes freshly planted. Everything's remarkably clean. You'd never guess that 10 years ago, this town was barely even there. It was wiped off the map by a massive tornado. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. Central Standard is glad to be back today. Greensburg, Kansas is back too, but it's different than it was before. And joining us to talk about that is KCUR's Frank Morris. You've been covering this story for NPR and for KCUR for the last 10 years, Frank.
That's right, Brian.
And I wonder if you could take us back to that place. Take us back. Actually, you know what I want you to do? I want you to take us back to before the tornado. What would you have seen if you walked into the town of Greensburg?
You know, it was a leafy town. People always talk about the trees. And, you know, Greensburg had a little claim to fame. It had the largest hand-dug well. So there was a little extra civic pride as they're on a kind of a sort of a major highway. But the town was losing population pretty quickly. There had been some layoffs in the gas industry where these gas pipeline pumping stations used to employ lots and lots of people, and they were really well-paid mm-hmm. jobs. Greensburg is on a major gas field, the Huguen gas field, one of the largest gas fields in the world. And so those jobs were automated, so there was a pretty steep loss of jobs happening before the tornado. But otherwise, people describe it maybe sentimentally as an almost an idyllic little town.
Little town that just wasn't doing so well financially.
Like any of the rest of those little towns out on the high plains. Those towns were built for an era when you needed a town every 10 miles just to put water in the choo-choo train.
Right.
And that went away. And then all these little farms there used to be so many people living in the countryside that aren't there anymore working on farms. And these little towns used to be vital to all those farmers.
So you've got this idyllic green leafy town, totally destroyed basically.
95%. There was a little bit of the town missed by the tornado. Very few houses, and but a few buildings standing. The grain elevator, famously, just standing there like a rock. I don't know, 8 or 9 stories tall. You know, reinforced concrete. But otherwise, yeah, it was. I mean, and it wasn't just. You know, people described it. It compared it to Hiroshima, and there was actually side by side pictures in the London Times of Greensburg and Hiroshima.
Wow.
And I mean, it was bad. You know, this is a really, really enormous tornado, 1.7 miles across, 205 mile an hour winds, and it just, you know, it's like you take a town and you put it in a blender. And you buzz it in the blender for a while, and then you spray it out across the field. And that's what it was like.
Which is a pretty incredible image, especially in light of what's happened right afterward. Pretty quickly afterward, you saw these groups of town leaders sort of going on TV and making announcements about what was going to happen in this town. And what did they say?
Well, I mean, the first thing, Darren Hedrick, the superintendent, he's one of the real heroes of Greensburg. Day after the storm, he's saying, look, towns are about people. They're not about buildings. We're going to have school August 15th on schedule next year. And that was he laid down a marker to get things going so that people wouldn't just abandon the place. And then there were, you know, there's kind of a different origination stories about this, but there were some informal conversations going on. And out of those informal conversations, somebody turned around, maybe it was Lonnie McCollum, the old mayor, it might have been Governor Sebelius, and said to the media, to like 40 million viewers at home, we're going to rebuild green. And then they were locked in, and then they sort of figured it out from there. And then there's a guy named Daniel Wallach who was thinking the same thing, and he piled in, and then they were off to the races.
So they went off to the races. They did it. They built this town. Yeah. Give us the short version. What does a green city, their commitment to build a green city, what does a green city population 800 look like?
Well, I mean, you know, the real standout stuff was all the super high efficiency buildings that they built. And there are 6 LEED Platinum buildings. And at the time, there weren't many more than double that in the country. And so, you know, there are 12 states where you'll find that don't have 6 LEED Platinum buildings. So they built those, and they made, and that was a stated commitment. You know, we're going to build LEED Platinum. The county courthouse was badly damaged. They built that back LEED Gold. They've got little wind turbines, kind of a few of them around town. They've got a small wind farm that produces more than enough power for the town. And a lot of the houses, you know, there's some odd looking geodesic dome. There's a geodesic dome house. There's a couple of houses that are built like a grain elevator, except for, you know, 1 or 2 stories. But a lot of the houses are really efficient too. Some people really took this to heart. Some people didn't. But now, you know, they also have a whole bunch of vacant lots and even foundations, stairs that don't go anywhere, still left in the town, because the town is much smaller than it was before the tornado.
Which hints at some of the sort of the unforeseen consequences of how this town rebuilt. I want to talk with one of the people who was attracted to the rebuilt town of Greensburg, Shelby Smith. She's joining us by phone this morning from Greensburg. Shelby, welcome to Central Standard. We're glad you're here. Where were you 10 years ago when the tornado destroyed Greensburg?
Yeah, so I actually grew up about 30 to 45 minutes away from Greensburg and right near our area. I lived on a farm, and we got hit as well. So I was there that night. I was in high school at the time, and my parents were in Manhattan. And everybody has their own story, and I remember mine, but I remember hearing on the news that Greensburg got wiped out, and then right around us, my house didn't get hit, but our farm got hit, and we had a couple die right south of our house as well. So it hit just as close to home for me.
And before the tornado hit, and maybe even after, how did you feel about, you know, growing up on a farm in rural Kansas in the Greensburg area? Did you love living there? Did you love growing up there?
Well, it was kind of a love-hate relationship. I loved growing up on a farm, but I told myself I'm never coming back to this area. I didn't think I'd ever be back in this area, and I didn't think I'd be part of the agriculture sector as I was. I got out of here, and I went to school at K-State and started in agriculture, actually, because it's what I knew, and then I decided, you know what, I want to travel the world, and I did do that while I was in college, but I majored in hotel and restaurant management, but I told myself I didn't want to come back to this area, and sure enough, I'm back here, and I'm very happy about it.
Well, you didn't come right back right away, though. I mean, you followed your bug, and you went and saw the world, and where'd you end up?
Yeah, so I've been kind of all over. I spent a lot of time in Australia. I went to Poland, Slovakia, Taiwan, lived in New York for a little while, and lived in Kansas City right before I came back here. So,
yeah, well,
everywhere.
Which is, you know, the typical path to opening up the Crazy Mule Food and Brew in Greensburg, Kansas. I described it a little bit at the start of the show. How do you describe your restaurant to people?
Yeah, for sure. Well, crazy is definitely a good word for it. I think it fits the town well. When I think of Greensburg, I kind of think of an oasis in the middle of the plains or in the middle of the ghost towns in western Kansas. You're driving through all these small towns that have really old-looking buildings, and then a lot of people that don't know the story behind Greensburg are very shocked when they come here. It looks like a new town just sprung up right in the middle of nowhere. And then when you walk into the Crazy Mule, like you described a little bit, it looks like something that is in the middle of a larger town that is a little bit almost indie or a little bit off the beaten path, with hanging chandeliers of windows with lights hanging out of them, windmills with lights hanging out of them. Kind of just quirky when you walk in. And mm-hmm. We have a pretty standard American menu, but with a little bit of odd and different menu items. We have a blackberry grilled cheese sandwich or a peanut butter burger, and we try to just make it a little bit different than everything else, which kind of fits the standard of Greensburg compared to all these other small towns of 1,000 people or less.
Right, but not the kind of place that would have opened in Greensburg before the tornado.
Right, exactly. I mean, I grew up in the area, and when I came to Greensburg, they had a Pizza Hut and a few other small little cafes, but nothing really like this.
It seems like quite a risk to come back to open a restaurant in a new town before the population has really returned in any significant numbers, or before any growth has happened, certainly. Why would you do that?
For sure. So I had been out of college for a few years, and this opportunity had come up, and I was very nervous about the whole thing, but I told myself I don't know when I'll get the next opportunity to build my own restaurant from scratch, face these challenges that I have to face, and kind of challenge myself with my creativity, use my own design skills, learn how to make specials on a menu, the marketing for a small town, and what all I have to do to make a restaurant like this work in a small town. So going into this, I actually did quite a bit of research before I decided, okay, let's do this. I looked at how many people travel down the highway each year, how many people live in this town, of course, how many people are wanting a restaurant like this, and what else Greensburg has to offer. I had worked in a lot of events and did event planning before, so I was also thinking of how we could get people into Greensburg other than just living off the locals and living off the
sure.
people around here.
And so you crunched the numbers, and obviously you decided it would work or you wouldn't have come. Frank Morris, you know, you've told us the story. The town gets together, it rebuilds, it attracts people like Shelby to come back and open restaurants. All in all, this sounds like it's this great success story in the making. You went back to Greensburg. What have you found?
Well, I've been back a couple of times, and you know, not just people, you know, thousands of volunteers, at least $70 million, federal money, state money. So lots and lots of money spent in a small town. And, you know, it's where it is now is kind of holding steady. The population hasn't really grown. I mean, it's maybe 60% what it was before the storm, which is up a little from, you know, 10 years from 5 years ago.
Uh-huh.
But it's not taking off, and it's kind of locked into this sort of chicken and egg problem where there's housing there is much more expensive than it is in neighboring towns where you have a bunch of empty houses, old houses. Rent is much, much higher. And so there's not a lot of, it's not affordable. It's not competitive. The housing is not competitive there. Mm. If you build a house, you're going to lose money, probably. And so people aren't building houses, so there's not room for people to move in with employees. And so you get, you know, employees for, you need employees for housing, you need housing for employees, and the place is kind of at a stalemate right now.
Shelby, does that describe your experience as a now restaurant owner in this town?
Yeah, for sure. It's kind of, like you said, out of stalemate, almost treading in mud at this point, because the housing and some of the expensive portions is one of the issues that we face. However, there are a lot of, I guess that's something that also attracts me to Greensburg, is there are a lot of, I guess pioneers is a good word for it, people like me that are coming in here trying to attract more jobs in the area. I mean, I was looking down Main Street yesterday and thinking about all the businesses in Greensburg, and we have 5 restaurants, 2 gas stations, a grocery store, movie theater, clothing boutiques, flower shops, hair salons, all these different businesses, and we have art center that actually bring art into town. We have a theater that's the biggest between, I think, Wichita and Denver, and they have showings for sensory awareness, like autism showings, that they have special showings for. We have a 3D printing business that with the 3D printers, they actually print cool stuff like that. We have a great media center with drones and everything like that. So there's all these people that are trying to think outside the box, and you see all these businesses, and if you just saw the list of businesses, you wouldn't ever guess that, one, it's in southwest Kansas, and two, that it's a town under 1,000 people. So I guess there's a lot of people here that are trying to figure mm-hmm. out, even though it is a little bit of a stalemate and a little bit of a challenge, how to push through that, get people in here, and even have people visit from far away. And since I've had the restaurant open, we've had multiple tours and different people come in just to learn more about the 3D printing or learn more about the green resources here in Greensburg
sure.
and everything like that. So there's a lot of people here pushing to make this work, and I think that's the important thing to look at is We see the problem and the issue, and we're trying to figure out how to get past it.
Well, and I appreciate that, Shelby. And Frank, Shelby seems really positive about the possibilities for the town, but she acknowledges that the problem that is being addressed. I mean, how is morale in the town more generally?
Oh, I'd say it's pretty good. You know, I mean, I talk to a lot of people who are pretty upbeat. But those are the people who want to talk with you. I mean, not everybody does.
And, who doesn't? I mean, who's not happy about how things have turned out?
Well, people who moved away and people who left. Not all of them are very happy. And people who live in the surrounding towns, there's a fair amount of resentment, jealousy directed at Greensburg. You know, not only because, you know, they're out there doing something that might be considered liberal, but they're also, you know, got a lot of money, they got a lot of attention, and in a way that I think there's a sense in the region that Greensburg's kind of sucking the life out of the rest of the little towns, because Greensburg, as Shelby says, Greensburg has lots of businesses, even though it doesn't have very much of a population, so it's becoming a little mini business center almost.
Frank, you're a fan of rural Kansas. Would you go back with your family to Greensburg for a weekend getaway?
No. You know, I mean, my family actually wants to go to Greensburg, but you know,
I'm sorry, I don't mean to stir up family trouble with the question.
No, it's just, you know, I mean, I would go and stop and, you know, go look at the big well. Think about this, you know, 13-year-old son. This is an interesting thing. It's a place I would stop in, but I wouldn't spend the night.
Which leads me to my last question for you, Shelby. What's your hope for Greensburg? Do you want it to be a much bigger place that attracts a big weekend getaway crowd, or are you happy with the direction it's going?
I don't think it necessarily needs to be a big weekend getaway. I don't think any small towns in western Kansas are going to be a big weekend getaway. Reasonably thinking, I think it's a good place for people in the surrounding area to come and shop at the Turquoise Ranch Boutique or get their flowers or do things like that. Or if you're driving down the highway, stop in at Greensburg. So I really hope that it just stays vital in that sense and starts to bring younger people back that they can have an opportunity here to build upon and build families and build their own businesses here. Because, I mean, if you're going to other small towns, there's a lot of other places that I wouldn't have had that same opportunity unless I went home and got married to someone.
That's Shelby Smith. She owns the Crazy Mule Food and Brew. Thanks, Shelby, for being here.
Thank you.
And KCUR's Frank Morris. You can find his work at KCUR.org and NPR.org from his visits to Greensburg. Thanks, Frank.
Sure. See you, Brent.
Coming up, how is your life different because you are white or because you are not? It's a pretty simple question, but the answer and the underlying reasons for your answer and what that answer requires of you in today's world, there's vital conversation happening in Kansas City about that. We'll join it when KCUR Central Standard comes right back. I'm going to say two words, and I want you to pay attention to your reaction to them. White privilege. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison, and for Gina Kaufman, we're taking a look at a concept that a couple thousand people came to Kansas City to talk about last month. What response do the words create for you? Reflection? Frustration? Curiosity? Defensiveness? It's that range of reactions to white privilege and what local people are doing to understand it, respond to it, dismantle it, that is our topic today. And I want to start with one of the people who was on the host committee for that conference, Cecilia Belzer-Patton. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
So, Cecilia, can we talk about those words for a minute? Why do they call it the White Privilege Conference? Why not the Dismantling Racism Conference or the Getting Together to Make the World Better Conference? Why the White Privilege Conference?
Dr. Eddie Moore, Jr., who is the founder of the White Privilege Conference, holds very strongly that he wants that to be the forefront of people's minds when they are attending or presenting or in any kind of communication about the White Privilege Conference. I believe he started it in 1999 in Iowa, and it was about white privilege, and he still feels like it is that. And so he's pretty firm on making sure that is how it remains.
And is that because he thinks if you don't put that up front, there's some consequence? It gets people out of thinking about some things they need to?
I don't know that to be sure. Mm-hmm. I am clear about in communication with him that he has very much wanted it to be something that is at the forefront of realizing that that is a part of systems of oppression and racism. And so, yes.
How did you first get involved in this work?
I've always had an interest in critical race theory back even from college. And as an educator and always an urban core educator, it's very important for me to help my students, families, and communities understand the imprint of oppression and how, even when we don't realize, how it makes us move as people of color.
And just help us understand, what is critical race theory?
Critical race theory is looking at how race and culture has played a part in power and how people are based on how they've been colonized in many ways with us in the United States, and how race is a construct. It's a man-made thing. And so Paulo Freire has said that the architecture of race is very much intentional. And I think we have to realize that the architecture of dismantling race has to be intentional as well.
So you've been working on these issues for a long time, for most of your career, right? So,
I would say for most of my life as a black person.
Well, yes. Very, very well said. And mm-hmm. So you know what this landscape is like in Kansas City. Why mm-hmm. why would this national conference, the White Privilege Conference, come to Kansas City? What is it about coming here that made sense?
You know, from what I understand, host cities approached Dr. Moore about wanting to be a part of this conversation. And Eva, I want to make sure I pronounce Schulte's, uh-huh. Yes. Eva Schulte, formerly of CCO, now of Travoy, Inc., here in Kansas City, approached Dr. Moore in Louisville, Kentucky 2 years ago and let him know that she was very interested in it. And I think really made a push for that last year when it was in Philadelphia. I do think that Kansas City is a very fertile space for us to be able to have these conversations. I think those of us who are concerned about these things and interested in how race and power has played out how our city moves, Troost Avenue is just one example of the ways in which that has happened. All the architecture and infrastructure of J.C. Nichols and things that has happened with neighborhoods. I think Kansas City was the right place for it to be.
Yeah. As you perceive it, at least, who's the target audience for a conference like this, a conversation like this? Is it for people of color? Is it for white people? Both?
I think it's both. I think one of the things that happens is that even people of color are affected by white privilege because there's what is called internalized oppression that occurs, that we move in ways that we aren't even aware of. France Fanon in Black Skin, Black Mask, which is a treaty on race, talks about that even when there's evidence of racism, of power construct that is not helpful for us as people of color, that oftentimes we move in response to how we've been conditioned and colonized to move. And so I think it's a conference for hopefully us all to look at ways in which our privilege plays out. Definitely my privilege as an educated African-American woman is different than oftentimes my students and families that I am in relationship with. So I think that it's a conference for everyone. You can move in at the beginning level of just learning. You can move in at the intermediate level or advanced level. So,
and I should mention at this point that I actually was a registered participant in the conference. The other work I do when I'm not at KCUR involves education and advocacy around issues of sexual orientation and race in my particular nice. Religious context. And so that's why I was there. I was one of the folks who was there. Who doesn't come or who didn't come to the conference? Does that question make sense? Who doesn't choose to attend this sort of thing?
I think that people that don't want to really deal with that issue, that Tim Wise, who is a known kind of critical race theory person, also Peggy McIntosh, who talked about the invisible knapsack of white privilege.
Kind of invented the term.
Yeah. They've talked about Midwest nice. And I think that we have an issue of wanting to be nice, of wanting to pretend like these things don't occur when in fact they do.
Well, for the rest of the world, that wasn't at the conference. I want to try to understand this idea a little bit better. Jamila Jones is joining us from the studios of KPR in Lawrence. She works at KU now. When she was a student, she was the first person to have a pretty interesting role there. Jamila, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And what was that role that you had as a student at KU?
As a student, I was the very first director of diversity and inclusion for the Student Senate here.
And what did you do in that capacity?
Yeah, that was a brand new position that definitely didn't come without student activism on campus that had been demanding that the Student Senate Executive Board, so of all the student body, the president, vice president, secretary, treasurer, and so on, that there be a position dedicated to diversity and inclusion on that board. And so the vast majority of my job was getting a feel for what the campus was like, for what underrepresented students and what underrepresented student groups needed out of Student Senate. That was the vast majority of my job as being kind of the first person to hold that position.
You know, I am not sure a lot of people, and maybe white people especially, I'm not sure about mm-hmm. that, would understand or why a role like that would be necessary. Why underrepresented people, as you say, needed sort of a particular advocate voice. How do you explain that to them?
I explain it in the simplest terms, that in every other facet of life, we seem to understand that people with particular interests and particular needs require particular entities to address those needs, right? So nobody says, well, there shouldn't really be a country music awards because there's all kinds of music that matters exactly. And that's important. Nobody says that, right? No one says, well, you know what? We don't need to just have Christian churches. We need to have all kinds of churches, but we need to only have Christian churches because that's the only religion that matters, right? We don't do that because we understand that people with particular interests and particular needs require an entity to address those needs. Mm-hmm. And so that's always the challenge that I give to white folks who say, well, why should there be a Black Student Union? Or why should there be a BET? Why should there be a Black History Month? Why should there be a Director of Diversity and Inclusion? Because it seems to work in every other facet of life. People with particular needs and particular interests require an entity to address those needs and interests.
And Jamila, was there a certain thing that happened? I'm sure there are many things, but can you think of a particular instance while you were there or since you've been at KU where you said, oh, yes, this is why we need this job. This is why this is something that still has to be happening on this campus.
Oh, it was at my, I guess they would call it a confirmation. The general term for that is a confirmation. Student Senate runs quite similarly to the United States government. And I guess we can put a pin in that and talk about it later. But right, so it was
so
at my confirmation.
You were appointed to this role, and you had to actually answer questions from senators about whether you should have that job.
Exactly. Right. So going through this process, and of course, I made it through, and everyone, I was actually conferred the position in front of all these people. And I'll never forget it. As everyone clapped for me, I looked at their hands, and I don't know what made me zero in on, it's like having this out of body experience. And I didn't realize that I was looking so closely at the hands of everyone who was clapping for me. And I realized I am one of maybe three Black folks in this room. This room is overwhelmingly white. What does this mean? This is so important, and this is so necessary, and this is why I'm here.
How does that connect with this idea of white privilege? Is white privilege the reason that there was an overwhelming majority of white people in that room filled with Student Senate members at KU?
Yes, because yes, and. So the idea of white privilege always gets a little bit of pushback because, especially from people who are really resistant to the idea of things just being quote unquote handed to you, right? So, well, Jamila, are you saying that the only reason why we were in Student Senate is because we're white? No, I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is that there is a reason that the overwhelming majority of these students are white. Even outside of a Student Senate context, there is a reason that the majority of students at a predominantly white institution are white. And that is not because the Black students or the students of color just don't work hard enough for their education, right? Mm-hmm. Which is another pushback line that I get. Well, it's all about how hard you work, and it's all about just, you know, putting your head down and making sure you get your education. The idea that education and then therefore student involvement is all just this level playing field is really a misnomer, and it's one that we want to believe is true, but it's actually not, and it shows itself in instances like the one I just mentioned.
I want to talk to you more about that. I also want to talk to our listeners about that and have them talk to us. We want to know whether you feel like you've experienced white privilege. Give us a call at 816-235-2888. And I'd like to hear from both white listeners and people of color to share your take on that idea out of your own experience. 816-235-2888. Gina Van Sickle is here with us. She's part of the steering committee for SURGE, Standing Up for Racial Justice, Kansas City, which is an organization that, well, actually, Gina, you tell me, what is SURGE?
Well, SURGE, Showing Up for Racial Justice, is our purpose is really to organize as many white folks as part of a multiracial movement to challenge the white privilege that we're talking about, challenge racial oppression. We are part of the National SURGE Network as well, and we really abide by about 7 points of unity that inform all of our work. But we're involved in a lot of things in the community, from trainings to direct action, solidarity action with POC-led groups.
People of color.
People of color. Thank you. And so we're really, again, our goal locally is to have a place to really encourage white folks to join this movement.
You know, I was struck, Gina, by something at the White Privilege Conference, mm-hmm. which was that there are caucuses where people are asked to go to groups that are intentionally segregated by race. There's a white caucus. Sounds a little bit to me like SURGE, which sort of has put this focus on white people doing this work. Why is that a good thing?
Very frankly, when you gather a lot of people in a white space and they have to address these really touchy issues like white privilege, there's a lot of feelings that come out, and those really have to be addressed. They have to be worked through. They're real. These are real traumatic feelings that folks feel, but it's not the responsibility of people of color to care for white folks in that space or to help them through that process. The most specific example I can really think of post-election was attending a One Struggle meeting here in the city. One Struggle is a local POC-led group. And we did split into affinity groups like you're talking about. And I was part of kind of wrangling the white group in the back of the room. And then there were people of color. And when we got back into the group space to really talk about processing through the things that our groups were addressing, the thing that I noticed predominantly was how many of the white folks in my group were really feeling grief about this election. And I can't count the number of times I've heard since the election the number of people who just could not get out of bed for weeks. They're just so devastated. And those feelings are real. But then when you hear from the group of the people of color coming out of their groups was, you know, yeah, this is kind of how it's been. This mm-hmm. isn't anything new. It's also traumatic for us, but what are we going to do next?
It was more of a shock to the white caucus yes. at the gathering than the people of color.
Yeah, so we don't want white folks to take up those spaces.
Well, I guess that is, I think, the question. How do you partner with people of color? What are the things that you consider when doing that as a white person and as a community of mm-hmm. white people working on this? How do you, what are the pitfalls that you're trying to avoid, and sure. what are the things you're trying to lift up?
Well, when we talk about accountability to folks of color, it really stems from people that we're in real relationships to begin with, both individually within SURGE and also as a group. So we start from there. We don't go into any type of training or movement or direct action and take up that space there and make it about us. So what we really try to do is be supportive in spaces where we are invited to be a part of a direct action or a protest or a training. We tend to run things by our people of color power team. which is our accountability.
Tell me about that name. what is that name, People of Color Power Team?
Well, we have, and Cecilia has been a part of it here as well. But again, it's not a formal accountability process, which is something that we hope to have down the road. Our power team is a group of individuals that represent many different organizations that, for instance, show up to our mass meeting spaces. And when folks of color show up, we say to them, stay in the room with us if you want to be here. If you don't, move out into the space, these separate spaces you're talking about. But the individuals who've made up that power team are, again, these folks we're in real relationships with that we trust that they will tell us when we're messing up and that we trust we're going to do work in accordance with what is going to be the most benefit for this multiracial movement.
Yeah. Before we take a break, Jean, I want to ask you, why are you personally doing this? What is it about your story or your background that led you to want to get involved?
I grew up in a smallish Kansas town, and typical story, did not grow up around a lot of diversity. If there was diversity, it was very separate. I didn't have significant relationships with people of color. But I was always had a tendency to want to work towards social justice and racial justice issues, and that started early on. Out of school, after getting an education degree, I really wanted to teach in the public schools, but the program I went to, although we talked a lot about school equality and resources, there wasn't a lot of practice. Mm-hmm. And so I had to really kind of learn that on my own. To be quick about this, the most impactful situation for me when I first realized that I was white and really benefited from white privilege. And I had been doing this work for a long time. I'd been working in low-income housing. I was the only white person in my job. I really thought I had a handle on things. I got pulled over for speeding by a cop that worked at one of the complexes, patrolled one of the complexes that I worked at. And it was just this 10-minute kind of back and forth of joking, laughing, hi, how are you doing? And driving away and posting what I thought was a cute little story about it on social media and literally having someone say, well, it must be nice to be young and white and female. And it just hit me like, oh, no. I should have known these things, but I don't always know these things. We're in a constant process of evolving, and that was my wake-up moment.
We need to take a break, and when we come back, we'll take some calls. Is white privilege something you recognize from your own life? And if so, what, if anything, have you done about it? If not, how helpful do you think this conversation is to have? Share your story and your perspective at 816-235-2888. We'll talk more when KCUR Central Standard returns in just a moment. Welcome back to KCUR Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison in for Gina Kaufman. We're talking today about white privilege, the accumulation of advantages that create an unequal playing field in society. We're talking with our guests today, Cecilia Belzer-Patton, a consultant and educator, Jamila Jones, an academic advisor at KU, and Gina Van Sickle, who does nonprofit work. They all, in different ways, are doing work to address racism and this question of white privilege in the Kansas City area, or in Lawrence, in Jamila's case. We want to hear your story at 816-235-2888. And let's talk first with Marilyn in Prairie Village. Marilyn, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, thank you. Yes, I just wanted to share a quote that I've always stuck with me for many years from a former football coach, Barry Switzer. And he says, some people are born on third base and go through life thinking they hit a triple, which to me shows, you know, the situation of privilege in general. But people know they might have worked very hard to get from third base to home, but perceive that they had to go all the way around the bases.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Marilyn. Has that spoken to you personally in your life in some way?
Actually, I work for a company that embraced diversity in the late 70s and 80s, and it was a very positive experience because you know, that's when you realize that, and they had a set of guidelines of testing people, and if you passed the guidelines, you were, you know, available for promotion or whatever, mm-hmm. and it created a great environment, and race wasn't an issue, or, you know, being female or male or whatever, and I was a little disheartened as I later in my career to see that a lot of the younger people coming in didn't, you know, they didn't seem to have that. They seem to be going backwards in time, which really frustrated me.
Well, let's ask our guests about that. Let me ask about that first metaphor that Marilyn used for privilege, the idea that a person is born on third base and thinks they hit a triple. Is that a pretty good description of privilege?
It is. And Marilyn, thank you for that. It's so interesting that that's a quote that you use. My mother and Barry Switzer were born in the same town of Crossett, Arkansas. And so, you know, things kind of have a symbiosis way of working. That's very interesting. But yes, I believe that. I think that oftentimes, as Gina talked about, when white folks talk about they struggle with privilege because they say, oh, I've worked very hard. I've worked hard to get where I've come. And surely they have. And there's an aspect, too, though, of realizing that white people in the United States in particular, but I also believe worldwide, seem to come into the world with a different set of advantages than others do. I think as an educator, I cannot say to my students, work hard and you will get this, this, and that, because they have seen people that have worked hard their entire lives, and that has not been the case. And so there does seem to be an aspect of, like Coach Switzer said, you start out on third base and then you act like that you have started out at home base and hit, yeah, you know, all the runs that you need to get to third. Yes.
Right. You know, Jamila, Marilyn also mentioned that she feels like with younger employees who came into the company after she did, she felt like in some ways things were moving backward. I think we have this idea in our head that all of America's problems with prejudice or with racism are diminishing with younger generations. What's your observation working on a college campus?
Well, working on a college campus, you definitely realize that that people have learned to be nice and not necessarily learn to be not racist. Those are two entirely different things. I think we brought up earlier in the conversation about Midwest nice. As someone coming from the South, I come from Georgia, it's the same, right? This whole Southern charm and being nice, which makes it really difficult to have conversations about racism, right? And those are two different things. Like, talking about race is something that people are a lot more willing to do than to talk about racism. Those are two different conversations to be had, right? And so I think that being on a college campus has definitely taught me that I don't know if things are so much going backwards as they are feeding off of the idea that we can't have a problem with this being racism still because we're such nice people.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that call, Marilyn. And let's talk to Sabrina in Kansas City, Missouri.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I was going to make a comment about talking about race and moving past talking and moving to action, because I'm an African woman and I didn't realize that the racial tensions in Kansas City until Ferguson happened. And at the time, I was pregnant with my son, and I kind of looked around my circle of friends, and I realized that I was surrounded by a lot of white people. And so I took it upon myself to talk about it, and I would talk about it every time I had dinner parties, every time my husband and I would invite people over. And we'd talk about it, and everyone would feel like we've made progress, and everyone would feel good, and I would feel comfortable. And then I heard about Surge from one of my friends who's a social worker, and I started to invite one of my white friends to go to it. And then after a while, I was like, you know, if you can't make it, I'll come with you if you're scared or something. And no one ever went. And so I feel like the conversation about race is great, but I feel like we need to come up with, like, more ways to get people to do something about it, because talking is starting to get tedious. I feel like Ferguson happened so long ago, and I don't feel like we've made much progress, especially in Kansas City, to do anything past talking.
The jingling sound you just heard was Cecilia raising her arms in joy when you said, Sabrina, that we need to get past just talking about it and
yes,
doing something about
yes
it.
Yes.
Sabrina visited looked into Surge. Let me ask you, Gina, I mean, how do you help people make the transition from talking to action? What practically does that look like?
Well, and we've been around a year, so we're continuously asking ourselves that question as well. And determining ways where we can get folks to actually move into action. I will say personally, one of the things that I helped put together, it was last month, and it was a just kind of a mini training, and it was called Exploring Whiteness. And there was a lot of talk and analyzation. However, one thing I really imparted to them is, okay, let's, you know, you're going to have your feelings regardless, and mm-hmm. we can't gloss over those and pretend that you're not going to have, again, some trauma around these feelings of understanding what race really looks like. But here are now these feeders that you can plug into with our organization. So we have direct solidarity action. We have a crew that is constantly organizing folks to go out and protest. We have our political education team. We have our personal support team. But what we're really actually trying to do is we're not the keeper of these resources or the experts. We're trying to hand these over to folks. And we've had so many folks come in and say, this is going on in my neighborhood and I really want to address it. And here are ways that we think we can address it. Cool. Here's the information. You do the work. You gather as many people as possible. We're really trying to hand this forward and say, you do the work. But you can only do it in your own little space for the most part. I think that's where people have to wrap their minds around it. They get overwhelmed by this big idea.
Well, and I guess that for all three of you who've been doing this work for a long time, it does feel like it would be easy to get overwhelmed. I mean, to not feel like you can confront a systemic problem, and that's the case you're making, that this is a systemic problem, not just a problem of individual bias.
Right.
Yet there's almost a hopelessness that can kindle in people if that's the case. How do you deal with that?
I think that one of the things that tends to occur, especially with whiteness and white spaces, is this sense of fragility that I can't go on, that these things are so overwhelming that I can't deal with it. And as Sabrina suggested when she called in, and as Jamila suggested, and as I am stating, I will firmly say I'm stating, we as people of color, we don't have a choice with whether we deal with it or not. And so it behooves us to realize that we must move towards action. We must move towards having a voice. For those of us who feel empowered enough to articulate for groups of people, it does feel overwhelming. And yet we realize that we can't choose to be hopeless, that we have to be hopeful and willful in moving forward and activating our voices.
It's Dr. Kathy, who's joining us from Lawrence. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I have
pretty quickly, if you would, Kathy, too. I'm sorry, we're a little short on time.
Okay, I grew up in St. Louis, and, you know, as everybody knows, it's a predominantly Black city, but I did not meet my first Black person until I was 13, and that was just happenstance. And then, as I grew up, I moved to Lawrence, and because of the diversity in Lawrence, and ended up, and as part of my marriage, being part of a huge biracial family. And as an educator of 30 years, we went through a process involving diversity education, and the diversity education involved trying to help us understand how whiteness had affected us.
And Kathy, what's one thing you learned from that education?
That a lot of people have had some extremely shocking experiences, more shocking than what I have. And then in talking to my niece to get information, because we had to ask a Black person, which is very interesting, within 24 hours we had to ask a Black person many questions. Well, I called my niece, okay, who was an adult, and I was in tears.
Yeah,
I could not believe what she had been through in her life that she had never shared with us.
Kathy, I really do appreciate your call. Jamila, I want to give you the final word. You are an educator now, working with students. What are the key elements of the education you try to provide?
The key elements of the education that I try to provide are, one, that this is not a moral. Talking about privilege and talking about race and racism is rarely an attack on who you are as a person, on your family, right? Because we frame race and racism as an evil. And I think that we have to get to a place where we talk about systemic inequity rather than individual character if we're going to get past individuals and go towards some collective action to dismantle privilege and oppressive systems.
So an excellent final word. Jamila Jones, she's an academic advisor at KU. Also have Cecilia Belzer-Patton, who works with Just Systems, and Gina Van Sickle, who does nonprofit work and is part of the Surge Group, standing up for racial justice in Kansas City. Thanks to all three of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
That was a very brief swing through the subject of white privilege. You can listen back to the conversation and dig a little deeper and find out more by visiting our website, kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have that conversation ready for you later today, and all of our previous shows are already there. Tomorrow, we look at the deep passion for baseball in late Yordano Ventura's homeland, the Dominican Republic. We also talk with a couple of preppers, people storing up stuff and making plans for whatever might come of this world. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. In for Gina Kaufman, I'm Brian Ellison. Up to Date is next.